from PRI, Public Radio International.
Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston C.A. With American troops engaged in extraordinary exercises in nation-building in Haiti, and the American Congress considering revolutionary new global trading arrangements, it's clear that we inhabit a new world even if we do not yet have a new world order. What kind of foreign policy vision should guide our path through these new realms of action? And what's the correct balance of human rights, environmentalism, and other forces in shaping the foreign strategy of the United States of America? My guest is Ambassador Max Kampelman. Max, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you, George. I'm pleased to be here.
I'm delighted to have you here, Max. It's a chance for us to get your wisdom and your long experience in these questions. Questions, I suppose, one could call a vision. And I think that's just the way I'd love to characterize this conversation, Max. Visions and values. Let's start with one that I think has been very important to you. And let me pose this question very, very directly. What's our stake in the promotion of democracy worldwide, Max? And let me use the phrase I think that John Kennedy originally coined, the survival and success of democracy. I mean, do we have more than a rhetorical commitment to that in the conduct of our foreign policy?
We do. Through good fortune, and I think good policy, we're the most powerful nation in the world. And the only, as everybody now talks about, the only remaining superpower in the world. Now, I believe the American people would far prefer to let it rest there and live their own lives and let the rest of the world live their life. Live and let live would be our philosophy. Regrettably, however, that's not what the world will permit us to do, and it is not in our best interests to do. And I think it would be useful if we looked at the world. We live in a world in which the sound of a whisper or a whimper can immediately be heard in all parts of the world, wherever it may take place. The communications revolution is a real one. There's been a lot of discussion about how foreign policy is influenced by CNN, by television cameras, by radio. All of this is correct. The reason it's been influenced is that people see and hear, and as they see and hear, they are moved.
Precisely.
They're affected by it. It's as if it's next door. There was a time we could think about the far end of the world as being totally distant from us. But it really isn't.
So what you're saying is it's the nature of the world that compels our action in it, our integration in it.
And there is no such thing as too little or too much. It's there. We have integrated economics, integrated engineering, integrated science, integrated medicine. But our politics isn't there yet, which means we are disfigured.
Now, this is interesting to me, because what you're saying, and I like this use of example and even an allegory, it's powerful to me. You're saying, first of all, to me, that isolationism is a vice we really can't afford, I mean, or a flaw or a failing that we cannot afford.
Or it may even be a virtue if it's attainable, but it's unattainable.
It's unattainable. It's unattainable.
So it's irrelevant whether it's a vice or a virtue. It isn't there.
Mm-hmm. The practicalities of our world situation demand our involvement.
Demands our involvement.
What kind of involvement, Max?
That's, of course, the big source of controversy in our country, because as we said it earlier, we are the leading, most powerful country in the world, which means that we will set the tune. And setting the tune is the process we are now experimenting with in our country. We don't quite yet know how to do this.
Right.
The American people would prefer not to do it in the main. But I think the American people, when it's explained to them, will respond as they have always historically responded, namely, if it's rational, if it's reasonable, if it's consistent with our values, we want to do it.
Let me pick up on that very point, because I think, again, you have very, very eloquently explained this political moment for us as it is. If it's consistent with our values, I think that's the phrase that you've employed. Let me, to make this a very precise question, use a value with which you have long association, human rights. We now have, as we both know, the American military, active in various parts of the world, in pursuit of missions that it historically has, that are novel for it, that it hasn't been used for before. Human rights, Max, how important a part of our commitment to world problems in this post-Cold War world should that be? And how adventurous should we be in using old institutions in new ways to accomplish it?
Let me say that I think it is vital for us to concern ourselves with the issue of human rights. I don't think we have to be adventurous about it. I think we have to be rational and sensible about it. G.K. Chesterton once said that the United States is a nation with the soul of a church. And I think there's a great deal of truth in that. If our political leaders have a recommended course of international action for America, for our country, and explain it to the American people in a way that's consistent with their soul of a church, namely with their values, it is a policy which is likely to get support of the American society. Now, why do I say we don't have to be adventurous, but we ought to be reasonable? Because there are some areas where our entry or interference or concern may not be effective, may not be practical. We have to make that judgment at all times as to whether what we're doing is practical. I will say to you that that which is not practical today may become practical a day after tomorrow, which means that the goal must remain part of our vision. But how fast we move and how extensively we move toward that goal has to be a pragmatic decision.
Let me put an example in this, Max, or at least pose a question using an example on this very point you're making. And I love the Chesterton quote, "The soul of a church," and your reminder that anyone who wants to motivate this country should make a high-minded appeal to that very quality, but make it, again, I understand you, in a practical way, or related to a practical, pragmatic end. Think out loud for us on our intervention in Haiti along these very lines. I mean, have we acted in the spirit of the soul of the church? And is this very new thing, this very new kind of intervention, this intervention to build a nation, in a sense, the kind of thing for which you can foresee a useful, pragmatic outcome?
Haiti is a difficult challenge for us. My answer to you is this. If Haiti were not in the Western Hemisphere, but were in a different part of the world, let's assume Africa, where there are Haitis today, I would be very hesitant about recommending that American troops go to Africa in order to try to eliminate a military dictator, replace him with a democratically selected president, and out of the chaos of that moment, make the investments and take the risks that are inherent in altering that situation for the better. The reason why I have long supported more energetic action by us in Haiti is because it is our next-door neighbor, and I believe we have greater responsibilities to our next-door neighbor than we have to the resident of the village next to us, or the city or the state, not ours, but the next one.
Yeah.
And being our next-door neighbor, and one of the consequences of this is that we therefore feel the pain. Look at the refugees coming out. We feel the pain. We see the pain. Also, it's feasible. It's practical. It may entail a cost. It may entail a cost in lives. We've been very fortunate up until now. But I don't know what later today or tomorrow may bring. Right. It may entail a cost of lives. But it is worth the price, in my opinion, for us to show the rest of the world, A, that we're concerned about human values, that we can do something about them in our neighborhood, that we want to do something about it, and we want to try to assist that society.
I can't resist asking you this question at this particular point, Max, because in addition to being a participant in so much of our national life, in both the domestic and the foreign sense, you're also obviously a pretty astute observer. In the charged political climate in which we now live, and I don't think I have to elaborate on that, I think that's very clear to all of us. Can we again, Max, achieve I think has been our best expression in foreign policy, and that is a bipartisan foreign policy? Or is that impossible?
First of all, let me say the following. It's difficult to engage constructively in any kind of diplomacy or foreign policy without understanding that the ingredient of force is latent. It's there. Our diplomacy is stronger to the extent that there is an existence of a force. Our role is more vital because of our power, our military power. So particularly in diplomacy and foreign policy, since force is a latent ingredient, you no longer, in my opinion, can make decisions by a 51-49 vote. President Roosevelt was able to make certain important decisions by a 51-49 vote when he was concerned about the Hitler problem, because that's how close the vote was. But what you really need for dramatic action is a consensus, not unanimity, but a consensus. And that's where the human values comes in. That's right. Where the human dignity comes in. But you know, having been a participant in this area, I can tell you that you will never get bipartisanship, which you need, unless you can make all the parties feel that they're in at the takeoff and not only at the crash landing. And that has to be understood. And my concern is that too often Democrats opposed what Reagan wanted or what Bush wanted, and Republicans oppose what Clinton wants. In all cases, both parties must make an effort, and this must be led by the president. Whoever the president is must make an effort to think of himself not as a Democrat or as a Republican in foreign policy, but he must think of himself as president of all the people, mm-hmm. and must make a decided effort to bring the leaders of the other party into the decision-making process. Yeah. I regret, for example, that in spite of his campaign, President Clinton does not have any Republicans in his foreign policy-making apparatus. I think had he had it, his role would have been a lot easier. His task would have been a lot easier. But I do think not only that it's feasible, but indispensable, yes, if we are to play our role.
Well, again, I can only agree with that. That's very, very well stated, Max. I want to turn us towards some international institutions with which you've had some familiarity in the next part of our discussion, Max. Before that, though, let me take a moment just to say that this program is Dialogue, a presentation of PRI, Public Radio International. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guest today is Ambassador Max Campbellman. Ambassador Campbellman has a long and distinguished career in law, politics, and diplomacy. Among other distinctions, he chaired the United States delegation to the Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe in Madrid from 1980 to 1983. I want to, in fact, look at Europe today, Max, and look at a part of it with which you've had some very direct dealings and much effect. I speak here of Eastern Europe, to briefly state what is a very, very long and fascinating story. It, in a stunning way, was the work of the Helsinki Conference and its focus on human rights that led to much of the revolution and turn toward democracy we've seen in those countries. It's a complex question, a great deal of territory, a great many issues, but what's your general sense, since Helsinki, of the state of affairs in Eastern Europe now in terms of the march toward democracy? Are you reasonably content things are proceeding well, or are there problems that we're not attentive to?
I began negotiating with the Russians in 1980, as you indicated. And at that time, if somebody had said that within 14 or 15 years, Hungary, Poland, Czechoslovakia would be democratic societies and democratic nations, I would have said, may the Lord make it so, but I wouldn't have believed that it would happen. If somebody at that time had said to me, there are elections in Russia, I would have had the same kind of skepticism about it. So, if you take a historical perspective, one has to say a great deal of progressive forward movement has taken place since that period. Are there problems remaining? There are. There are very serious problems remaining. It takes time for stability to materialize. We, the United States, have made mistakes. They have made mistakes. Now, we all make mistakes, and we wish we didn't, but there it is, and you suffer the consequences of those mistakes. But there is something that your question does bring to mind that I feel I must now raise when you're talking about Eastern Europe and Central Europe, and that is the situation in Yugoslavia, in the former Yugoslavia. And the reason I must raise it now is because it's been my experience that the depression or the pessimism, which does exist in some parts of Europe and the United States about the future of Europe, is based on the inability of the West and of Europe and of ourselves to deal with the Yugoslav crisis and with the breakup of Yugoslavia. Now, you referred to the Helsinki Final Act, which is the East-West. It exists. Every country in Europe is a member of this, including the United States and Canada. We're all in it. And there's no doubt in my mind but that you're correct in saying that the work of this group and of the American leadership working through that group helped the disintegration of the Soviet Union and the freedom of Eastern Europe. But you know, there's a fundamental premise of that agreement. The same premise which exists in the United Nations Charter. It is. in addition to the human dimension, which it emphasizes, it also says that states have no right to invade other states using force. Boundaries, in effect, cannot be changed by force. That's a fundamental principle. Now, does that mean that all the boundaries are just or wise or historically justified? Not at all. What it does mean is that those who created these instruments of the United Nations Charter and the Helsinki Final Act understood that if we're to have stability and peace, you can't continue to have fights about boundaries that take a form of violence.
Boundaries cannot be changed by aggression.
Not by aggression. They can be changed by negotiation, by appeals to moral suasion, but not by aggression. Now, here you have Yugoslavia breaking up. Now, I think unwisely, but what happened was that the United States and Germany and the whole world recognized that breakup. In effect, we were less so involved, but we recognized the breakup and said each of these countries will be an independent state and will be part of the United Nations. Serbia, Bosnia-Herzegovina, Croatia, Macedonia, all of those places will be independent states. Once we did that and they became member states of the United Nations, their boundaries became inviolate boundaries. So what we in the United States and what NATO and what our European allies should have been saying from the beginning is, if you insist on being independent states, fine. Then you must respect the boundaries of one another.
To be faithful to the Helsinki Accords.
And be faithful to these accords. And we must insist that be lived up to. Because if you don't live up to it, then some aggressor some other place is going to say, you got away with it, maybe we can get away with it.
But this point amounts to an indictment of American and European inaction on this.
Is it
that,
does.
That's the precise...
And that's the thrust of my comment.
Right.
Now, I think we made the first mistake in not making an extraordinary effort to keep them together with a looser form of federalism. But we didn't do that. And we are today, what are we today saying about Bosnia-Herzegovina? We have labeled the Serbians war criminals, butchers. We've accused them of engaging in all kinds of cruel, and they have, horrendous things. They have not because they're Serbs and the victims are somehow better human beings, because the other side can come back with the same cruelty. They're all capable of it. The human being is capable of cruelty. But it's what we should instead have been saying is, if indeed you are butchers, if you've engaged in genocide, we can't permit you to gain from this. But you know what the American position is today and the European position? We say to the Serbs, you've captured now more than 70% of Bosnia. You have absolutely no right to do that. You can only keep 49%.
Yes, that's
now, what kind of a position is that? It's a terrible position. And I think is a consequence that we will suffer from down the road. But ultimately, putting that aside, and I hope we can somehow overcome that error we have made, I have confidence in the future of Eastern Europe. I think Hungary, Czechoslovakia, Poland, the Czech Republic, Slovakia, are capable of economic improvement. They have shown it. And I think Russia has great potential. The creative people.
I must say, Max, that one rarely hears arguments that powerful on questions of principle in foreign affairs these days. And the impression I take, and do correct me if I've in any way misunderstood the point, but that when we fail to act on principles to which we have, in effect, signed our national name, we, in a sense, fail ourselves. I mean, we are failing the Helsinki Agreement in one sense, the UN Charter in another, but it's also a failure of what this country stands for in these international events, and that is what can create problems for us on down the road.
It will. When I was called back three times during the Bush-Baker administration, each time for a month, twice for a week, so that's five times. There's two of those occasions were presidential summits. On the first in 1991 in Paris, at the end of 1991, the mood of Europe was euphoria, and mostly centered about the Helsinki Final Act. We had really made great strides in Eastern Europe, made great strides within the Soviet Union and Russia. The Soviet Union had agreed with us on democracy. I can tell you without going into great detail now that the Copenhagen document was, in my opinion and in the opinion of others, as great a document as the Magna Carta of the 13th century. Tremendous document. So there was euphoria. 18 months later, I went back to another summit, second heads of state summit, this time in Helsinki. And the Yugoslav crisis was involved. And I can tell you, there was a feeling of European impotence in the face of this first serious challenge to the new order. In effect, what we're seeing now, and it goes back to the resistance question, we have important signs and potential for a new globalism. But we are also seeing evidence of a new tribalism.
Yes, very well said.
And the fact of the matter is that there is nothing inevitable in this world of ours. And if we're not wise enough, and that means wise enough as a nation, because we are the leaders, if we're not wise enough to understand that we have a greater interest in a new globalism than we have in a new tribalism, and then act to strengthen the new globalism, we're all in trouble.
Max, that is such a powerful message that all I can do is say thank you very, very much for being with us on Dialogue, and I do hope you return soon and often. Thank you.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Ambassador Max Campbellman. I am George Liston CA, producer and host of Dialogue. Assistant producer is Dennis Saunier, and our technical director is John Tyler. Dialogue is presented by PRI, Public Radio International, and is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in association with Radio Smithsonian. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
For cassette copies or more information on Dialogue, call the radio store through your international operator at 1-800-747-7444. That's 1-800-747-7444. Contact us on the internet at radiodial@americaonline.com. That's RADIODIAL at AOL.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
From PRI, Public Radio International.